Hello, and welcome to episode 4.
Good morning, motherfuckers. Right now, we got a great show. We have Graham Hancock here to talk about what really happened with the pyramids. I don't think they were built. Don't know what Graham thinks, but we just smoked a pound of that Indica Kush hybrid sativa out of the new sativa cannon setup straight from Revolution Labs, the best weed technology you can get on the fucking West Coast. Quick word to sponsors, go to www.fleshlight.com and the code word Rogan. All right, you guys fucking ready?
Hell yeah.
I'm fucking ready to dominate this shit. Welcome, everybody. That was Joe Rogan. This is the Joe Rogan Experience. Episode 4, I'm Will Miniker, and with me, as always, is Matt Christman.
Sup, everybody.
And Felix Biederman.
Hello, everybody.
How are you guys doing?
I'm pretty good. I made the mistake of fucking up my dinner schedule. I'm just another 9 o'clock dinner for me tonight. That's the kind of sacrifice you go to in your life as a content creator, but whatever.
I've been eating Clif bars for 48 hours straight.
That's good. That's what Joe wants.
Get on my level. I have been dissolving slowly a frozen Soylent enema that's been in my ass for the last week and a half. I haven't had to deal with any petty consumption primitively from my mouth. Getting a steady stream of nutrients that allow me to open minds on the web and also in meat space.
Well, it's been a hell of a week. It's been a great week for us because the Chapo Trap House continues to grow and grow. Thanks to everyone for listening. We have been doing ignorant numbers on the old SoundCloud. I think basically, as of the time of us recording this, I think we are at something like 10,000 plays on SoundCloud, which is absurd.
Keys open doors, and we got 10 keys.
We're bringing big bricks in on the cigarette boats. We're bringing it to all of you via iTunes now. We are on iTunes. I haven't looked at our numbers on that, but if you're listening to this, you should be aware that we are on iTunes now. So basically, wherever you're at, we will find you with this excellent content. And one person we found with this excellent content was Colin Griffith of the Onion AV Club. We actually got a little write-up in their weekly Podmass section. We were listed along with some of the greats like Radiolab, Hardcore History, and actually the Joe Rogan Experience, I believe, was on the same write-up. But we got our first official media notice, and I'm hoping that this will be the first of an ongoing series called Chapo Press Clips. And I'm just going to read to you now from the write-up in the prestigious Onion AV Club. Chapo Trap House is not for everyone. Okay, right off the bat, I'm going to say I agree with that. Plenty of potential listeners will be turned off by the very far-left political leanings of the host. Felix Biederman, Will Miniker, and Matt Christman, each minor Twitter celebrities in their own right.
That's right, bitch.
I've been waiting so long for those words to be applied to my name, but yes.
I was a major Twitter celebrity before I was suspended, and they took it from me, but just leave that out of your article. This is why people don't trust the press.
What I also like about his little intro about it saying some listeners will be turned off by the very far left political leanings is that I hope there's some tankies listening right now going, that is fucking bullshit, man. They're feds.
We're a psyop, you idiots.
We're fucking fascists, man.
Everyone knows that iTunes is a NATO project.
Just look at where the funding came from. I mean, come on. All denominated in U.S. Federal Reserve notes. Follow the frickin' money. That's all I gotta do.
Qui bono? Who benefits? Okay, continuing on in the review, he says, but even those who agree with their politics might prove allergic to the consistently poor audio quality of the show. And okay, I'm going to stop you right there, Colin, because, you know, you're probably weaned on shows like This American Life and, you know, the well-polished and produced podcast that you're used to reviewing. But that is not the aesthetic we're going with here.
This is some punk DIY shit here.
Yeah, exactly. This is the Trap House. I model myself after, you know, the Migos in a lot of ways, but I'm also going for, like, I view myself very much as a Sid Vicious of our times, in that I'm not particularly talented or likable to virtually anyone, but years later I will be revered as a genius after I kill someone and then die myself.
And like for myself, I'm much like Johnny Rotten. I have spent tens of thousands of dollars on in-game freemium app upgrades.
I compare myself to Osama bin Laden, the real punk rocker of our time, who he didn't have high production values. You can see a boom mic in the videos that he shot in Afghanistan, but still, nonetheless, got a lot of followers and accomplished a lot, whether you agree with him or not.
9/11 is really the number one trending topic of the 21st century.
Yeah, and the biggest startup. Al-Qaeda was a startup.
I mean, I bet some people were turned off by the consistently poor audio video quality of his productions, but to be honest, CNN did a lot of the work for him.
Yeah, I mean, that's free press, and also, like, people who are turned off by poor audio quality, they're not going to die for you, and that is what we're expecting of everyone who listens to this show.
Yeah, we don't need those guys who want to listen to that Radiolab shit that's all smooth, and it's like, everybody who makes and listens to those shows is basically walking around on the verge of tears at all times. All it would take is, like, the right credit card commercial to set them off.
This show is This American Death is really what we're going for here.
God damn.
It's like, what if instead of Ira Glass, it was hosted by fucking Joker?
Oh, well, yeah. We'll get to that in a second.
You might be used to Prairie Home Companion, but this is Prairie Home Enemy.
Okay. Wait, so Colin goes on. So he dings our audio quality, but he says, oh, God. And yet it feels like an absolutely essential listen. The hosts have gripes with people at every point along the political spectrum, and although they are often lamenting many of the events of the week, their energy and desire to improve the political landscape of this country is not only unparalleled, but also contagious. If listening to this podcast doesn't make you want to become a more politically engaged person, it's hard to imagine what will. So, I mean, hell of a review from Colin here. So I want to thank him a lot for noticing the trap house and putting us out there a little bit.
Yeah, he's part of the family now.
Colin's part of the Chapo Mafia. We're going to roll him in later, but glad you're out there. I also I want to give a shout out to Mexicanarchist on Twitter, who he's been listening to the show. He had some very kind things to say. He said it was one of the best podcasts he's ever listened to. But he also shared a photo of like his car stereo, and it had Chapo Trap House was like the song that was playing on the little digital display, and he shared that with the comment of, remind me never to listen to this show while I'm driving through Mexico, I still have the will to live. And I sort of say thank you to Mexicanarchist, but that tweet it did make me slightly think twice about choosing to name our show after a notorious mass murderer, but it was either that or Nasrallah Boys, and I didn't want to be accused of ripping off Desus and Miro. So,
yeah, it's true. And also, like,
and didn't you listen to the Sean Penn interview or read that? I mean, Chapo's misunderstood.
Also,
free Chapo.
You know, like, yeah, you may get killed if someone sees the display name in Mexico, but, like, again, like, if you're not willing to die for this, like, poor audio experience, then, like, what are you doing? Like, go listen to Planet Money, because you're not ready for a podcast.
You're not ready for this real shit. You know, irony is like wielding a sword without a hilt. It's a dangerous game. It can cut both ways, but I think it's one that we've mastered. The liquid sword of irony.
We wield the sword like the bastard executioner himself.
Absolutely. Next up, I just want to give a quick shout out again to at Troy's Brushes on Twitter. Made us a little Joker video to promo the podcast. It was very cool, but I want to say, Troy, thanks for the video, but it was the wrong Joker, buddy. It was the Heath Ledger Joker.
I mean, Heath Ledger Joker, okay, kind of twisted, a little bit messed up, but I mean, you can't compare him to the Leto Joker. Yeah, already legendary, and the film hasn't been out yet.
The Jared Leto Joker is the official Joker of the Trap House. I just want to get that out there right now. And Troy's Brushes, you are blocked and reported. Sorry, buddy.
I got to say, I haven't seen the video because I have to sort of work myself up to watch anything with the Joker. Puts me in a really bad place. It is really terrifying, but the Heath Ledger Joker, he points a mirror in society and says, "That's you, but it's also me." That's pretty twisted. But the Jared Leto Joker says, "Hey, society, I'm part of you." And that's the most terrifying.
Yeah. We might actually all be the Joker a little bit.
Yeah.
I just wanted to just have a brief digression to say that there's nothing funnier to me than the news announced this week that because of the reception, the warm reception that the Suicide Squad trailer has had, a trailer which has sort of a up-tempo, jokey feel, that Warner Brothers is spending millions of dollars to do additional footage and reshoots to make Suicide Squad funnier. And I just want – I wish I could have been there for the conversation when the studio executive calls the marketing guy up and says, "Hey, you know how we've been selling this thing as a soul-raping descent into madness for over a year now? We're going to just tweak that a little bit and go with Laugh Riot."
And he's not many people know this, but he's unscripted, but Louis C.K. has been brought in to do some of the rewrites.
The Joker has a really powerful scene where he's like, he's talking to the police commissioner and he's like, "You're going to arrest me for blowing up a school bus, but you know, my daughter shits into her cunt and I have a cell phone that can go anywhere, but I use it to look at pictures of fucking tits and my daughter's came out of my fucking cock with my cum and I hate her and she's beautiful."
Fuck, I could fit Batman in my ass. All of him. Fucking Batman in my ass.
We're all looking forward for the Suicide Squad movie.
We're going to obviously, we haven't discussed this previously, but I think we're all on the same page. There will be a special Chapo Trap House episode devoted to Suicide Squad when it comes out.
Me and Will will be seeing it together, and I've already worked on the costumes we're going to wear.
I might have to fly out for that. I got to say, it's pretty tempting.
We will
fly out.
We will get the chopsticks to project it.
Yeah, we're going to do an Indiegogo to send me to New York to watch Suicide Squad.
And last but not least, in the Chapo press clippings, probably the most important review of the show trickled in this week from none other than my girlfriend, my long-suffering girlfriend, who listened to our last episode and said, quote, "It's exactly like the internet. It's a bunch of guys talking shit and being sexist." So,
I hope you told her to smile, sweetie.
No, I told her I was in character, and that could have been a bit iffy, but I managed to pull it out of the bag by saying it was in character.
Well, have her send me some feet shots, please.
Well, no, she has a very busy schedule, what with being a model and living in Canada year-round, but she made some time to watch the show, or listen to it, rather, and I just want to say thank you. Thank you, sweetie.
Well, I have to say thank you to Will's girlfriend, but one of the women I am in a polyamorous relationship with, Artemis, told me the podcast was, in fact, not sexist enough.
I guess we got to go back to the old sexism table. Yeah. I actually have one of those, just so everyone knows. It's shaped like a naked lady, and there's 3D boobs on it. It's pretty great.
Every man should have one.
Yeah.
I mean, like a table shaped like a woman, not a woman.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's why you have the table.
Hey, guys, I don't mean to get...
Men going their own way.
I don't mean to get political here, but on the table shaped like a woman, is that where Mitt Romney keeps his binders?
Zing!
Full of women. Full of women.
Boom! If we had that soundboard by now, this is where there would be a nuclear explosion.
What are you doing?
Flush.
You're murked, Mitt. Deal with it.
So, okay. To kick things off this week, I guess you'd like to start with some more original on-the-ground reporting from one of our hosts. Felix, on Thursday this week, traveled up to the borough known as the Bronx with, I think, 18,000 other people to go see Bernie Blanco from the Bronx give a speech in a rally in the house that Ruth built. No, it wasn't in Yankee Stadium. It was in a park. What was it? Mott Haven or something like that?
St. Mary's Park.
Okay. So it's basically like the beginning of the Warriors, right?
Yes.
All the gangs, they come to the park in the South Bronx, and Bernie goes, "Can you dig it?" And then someone shoots him. But no, that didn't happen. Felix, how was it?
It was fun. Look, I've in New Hampshire, I went to a lot of things like this, and they ranged from infuriating, like Marco Rubio being unable to secure pancakes for his pancake breakfast, to the horrifyingly sad, like Carly Fiorina's last death grasp. Finale.
It was held the death rattle of Carly Fiorina.
That was a very sad one. But this was fun. Everyone wanted to be there. Rosario Dawson got up there. This is a classic strategy of the Sanders campaign to have a woman speak first so the audience can sort of get ramped up by harassing her. But she took it well. Spike Lee was there. He was very good. And, you know, Bernie did his usual thing. No one really changes their speeches except for John Kasich, who just tells varying versions of incoherent fucking stories from his childhood.
Sorry, you mentioned Spike Lee was there. Yes. It's good because I think She Hate Me would be a good official film for the Bernie Sanders campaign.
I agree, yeah. Or Do the Right Thing. Bernie Sanders was the racist Italian man from Do the Right Thing.
He's very similar to Sal's famous pizzeria.
Yeah. What are you talking about? Why do I have to put their pictures on the wall? It's not a picture restaurant. Ridiculous that they want me to put a picture of Martin Luther King on my pizzeria.
I walked with Martin Luther King.
The man hated pizza. He had no understanding of what a good pizza was. There's no reason for him to be on the wall.
Yeah. Hopefully someone will throw a garbage can through the window of the Bernie Sanders campaign sometime soon.
That'd be Tom Watson.
Yeah.
Tom Watson will do that.
I was going to think it would be a Hillary man who has a little more military experience.
Is there one, though? I can't think of one.
Name rhymes with Dieter Powell.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, no. I forgot about his war experience. Rosario Dawson, is she a fan of the podcast? Did you get a chance to ask her?
She looked directly at me.
Oh my God. I don't know if I could have handled that.
I didn't. Like three flies flew off my Levi's, but. She supports, you know, the same candidate that I support, and that's, like, I'm halfway there. And, like, after, you know, she's going to be campaigning other places, but when she gets back to New York, I'm probably going to ask her, like, once she follows me, I'm going to DM her, and I'm going to be like, first of all, have you listened to the podcast? And second of all, when she says yes, I'm going to be like, would you like to get halal chicken from the bodega downstairs and drink the CBS Nyquil with me, and then we'll be hung out, and we'll always be retweeting the podcast, and that's really my plan for growth.
No, we gotta amass a few solid celebrity followers, and I think
you're going to insist that you and her reenact the wedding night scene from Alexander. I don't know if anyone has seen that, but it's a seminal moment in film.
Well, you know, I've always felt very similar to Alexander the Great, especially the Oliver Stone portrayal of him.
But Felix, so what was I mean, there was a ton of people there. I mean, like, what was the crowd like? I mean, could you get a read on what kind of scene it was?
Well, the crowd, it was very young, very diverse. You had like sort of crunchy older like white hippie types sprinkled in. They were kind of like the they were around the perimeter, but it was like very enthusiastic young people who were really happy to be there. Me and Virgil Texas got caught in a lot of crowd shots where, of course, we're huddled over our phone, like giggling and stupid shit. So it just looks like, oh, look at all these beautiful, diverse young people. And look at these two fucking psychos, one of whom has a shirt like unbuttoned down to his navel because the buttons flew off, just staring at their phones. But also, you know, proving that it's truly diverse. Speech Boy 71.
Beach Boy, beloved Beach Boy.
It, also known as Michael Cohen. If you're a fan of the Trap House, chances are you're familiar with Speech Toy's work. But, I mean, it goes without saying we're all big fans of his. Love it. I respect his work a lot and him as a person.
I respect everything about him. When he tells me that I don't understand war and that it's understandable that sometimes you have to fucking level a hospital, like, yeah, I get you. I was excited that Speech Boy was there. He tweeted about it, and I was trying to triangulate his location, and I said, Speech Boy, I am at the rally, and I would like to photograph your goatee. He stopped tweeting after this. Maybe he left. I don't know. He got caught. Carl Digler says that he got caught in a restroom. In an adjacent porta potty to Speech Boy, but I don't know. These types of people are always getting caught places. But Speech Boy was really the only person of his type at the rally, I guess. By that I mean mid to late 30s goateed guy who likes war crimes.
And how was Bernie himself? He just sort of came out there and did his kind of like standard campaign, you know, his stump speech. Did the crowd get riled up? Were they people feeling it?
People were feeling it. They had a guy whose name I forgot. He's in a band. A guy from Puerto Rico on right before Bernie, and he talked a lot about Latin American policy, which I thought was interesting. Like you don't usually hear like a big, very specific foreign policy thing before a stump speech, but it got people really fired up. And Bernie did his usual thing that you always see, but it's, you know, it's fun to see. And people were loud as shit every time he hit one of his applause lines. His throat sounded a little sore, but you know, maybe he, like Sean Hannity, had an MMA workout that day.
Did you get a chance to talk to any of the harassment horde who came out to see him?
Just briefly, like, remark, you know, it's like the hack stuff. Like Bernie will say something about weed, like legalizing weed, and someone will go like, "You got a lot of votes for the hacks." But we were trying to find people we knew there, but I guess they don't want to be associated with the Carl Digler election team.
Did any men there tell any women there that they owed them sex?
Actually, when we got in, by the way, we abused our press credentials from New Hampshire to come in late. So that's what happens when you give people like us press credentials. They just show up late to things and don't report on them. They gave us foam fingers. But instead of saying, like, Bernie is number one, they said females listen up on them. And you're instructed to wave them in a woman's face if she's talking while Bernie was talking. And by God, we did that.
I mean, it seems odd that someone running for president would, you know, just do something that divisive as part of his campaign, like architecture.
Bernie has never cared about what's popular. He cares about what's right. Yeah, and what's right is that females need to listen the hell up.
Yeah, he got up there. The first thing he said is like, he was like, "It's good to be home. A lot of people have been saying that they're the female respecters in this race. Well, I've never respected females. And that was like, that was a big applause line. Like, people love that.
But the young women in the crowd also seem to like it, right?
Well, Bernie has internalized misogyny with them, and internalizing misogyny is a lot like a pregnancy. It's gestates over 9 months, and you go from the time where he sort of announced his candidacy to the time where he is now. They're like, they've given birth to that misogyny baby. So like now any man can go up to them and be like, listen up. You owe me smiles, and they'll be like, yeah, I do.
Oh my God, the revolution is happening, people. Can you believe it?
That's right.
I think Bernie was on This Week Today, and he said, my wife does my taxes for me. So he's got her in check.
Yeah. That seems like the typical lies of his people, though. I mean, they usually lie about their fiduciary responsibility.
The Jew is a trickster above all else.
I don't like the protocols of the Bernie Sanders campaign.
So Bernie Blanco from the Bronx, on a fun event. And the fact that most of the people there were sort of like enthusiastic and sort of excited to take part in it made it markedly different than your previous experience with campaigns.
Oh God, it was better than any previous experience I had. Not that that's a really high bar, but I mean, the only thing that compared was the John Kasich events, where people were happy to see John Kasich, but they're, you know, it's tempered, and it's tempered by Kasich's weirdness, and it's tempered by the fact that they're like usually very suburban people.
So it was a nice evening in the Bronx with Bernie Sanders.
Yes. Absolutely. I would do it again.
Sounds good. Moving on. Another topic that we want to discuss is sort of the odd coincidence of Antonin Scalia's death saving public sector unionism in America. What do you guys make of that? Because basically, what was the case that would have been decided otherwise? It was the big case to decide whether basically we're allowed to have public sector unions.
Well,
right.
It was essentially whether the right to work principle that people can get union benefits without contributing union dues would be extended to all public sector workers. And the lower court had ruled that that was not the case, and that public sector unions could still collect dues from people who had opted out of joining the union. This is, I believe, a teachers union in California.
So this was like the national right to work case. This
basically, well, for public sector unions, yes. Right. It would have, if the lower court ruling had been overturned, it would have basically extended right to work principle to all public sector unions or public sector unions in the U.S., which, of course, as we all know, means that they would be dried up of funds due to free riders, and their ability, their efficacy to be unions would be fatally undermined.
Yeah.
And so it was lower court ruling was in favor of the unions, and this was a case that had been hotly anticipated, and the conservatives on the Supreme Court had begged to get it. They wanted this puppy. This was a fat fastball right over the heart of the plate. They were going to knock it out of the park. And then fat ass Antonin Scalia had too many treats and keeled over, and they tied, and tie goes to the runner, i.e. the person who was winning, who won in the previous court ruling. And so, boom, public sector unions are saved. And to me, it just, more than anything, just shows how insanely idiotic the Constitution is and how just completely antiquated it is. Like, the ability of millions of Americans to collectively bargain came down to whether one fat old man decided to do some sit-ups or not. Like, if he fucking passes on hostess treats a few more times over the course of his life, he lives long enough to overturn a principle that has allowed millions of Americans to bargain for their livelihoods. I mean, and that's right. That's all as was intended in the Constitution, which is obviously not at all a document that is a hasty, messy, garbagey compromise that was thrown together by a bunch of slaveholders with tertiary syphilis.
Well, I would like to take the optimistic view. This chain of events shows what I've been saying for years, that Funyuns and Bugles and all the Texas Macs are inherently revolutionary.
So, pivoting off this, I want to use this as an excuse to do another little reading. We got a lot of great response to our Ross Douthat reading last week. This one's quick, but this one, this is something that came up right after Antonin Scalia died, and I think it speaks to the issue at hand here. This is in the Weekly Standard by a guy named Victorino Mattis. Great name. But the title of the article is A Man of Many Appetites.
Oh.
And what's funny about this is that this was written right after Scalia died as sort of a tribute to the great man. And I guess the thing to listen for here is if you listened last week, the Ross Douthat thing about William F. Buckley, just listen to the way these guys are so sentimental about these old creeps. It's like they're so in love with these guys, like these disgusting old men, and it's just like they're so sentimentally attached to them. It drips off every word. So, you know, this one's pretty quick, but I'm just going to begin. In 2008, I was invited to a wine and oyster pairing at the old Ebbett Grill. It was a great deal. Rank 20 glasses of whites in order alongside your liking alongside all the Olympia oysters you can drink. And then look who was there, Justice Antonin Scalia. This shouldn't have come as a surprise. Scalia was a man of many appetites. He was also built like a tank. Two chairs down from me, I could see the justice thoughtfully swishing around his glasses, gesturing to the waiter to bring over another ice tray of Olympias. In the end, I downed 43 oysters. Scalia had more. It was a sight to behold. I'm sure it was.
It's basically like if Mr. Creosote from Monty Python's The Meaning of Life was racist.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a sight. Just the thought of him just swilling wine and downing oysters by the dozen is extraordinary. It goes on. Afterwards, the judges were invited upstairs to a reception. At the bar, I caught up with Scalia, who confessed he preferred beer with oysters and ordered a beer at the bar. He also said that the white varietals were all too often reminded him of apples. At some point, he and I and the three other judges sat at a table. Scalia then proceeded to order dinner from the menu, even though we were still recovering from the competition. But he shot the rest of us a stare that got us all to order dinner. How could we not? Needless to say, it was a great dinner. Blah, blah, blah. Fuck, I can't even go on. But just the idea.
How could we not? How could I not fucking force myself to gorge on food while I'm nearly vomit because some old asshole gave me the stare down? Because I have no will of my own.
Similar to how Ross Douthat, he got drunk and naked. Like William F. Buckley got him to be nude and go swimming with him just on a whim. This fucking asshole, Scalia stared at him. He gave him a look, and then he just like, keep fucking eating after eating 50 oysters. I mean, think about that.
I mean,
he was built like a tank.
I mean, the implication of this is that guys like very well-regarded august figures in conservatism, your Strom Thurmonds, your Jesse Helmses, by the end of their lives, how many guys did they convince to let them fuck their wives?
You almost know? All of them.
I mean, that must have just been like a way to pass the time. It's like, oh, some guys, you're going to have a dinner party with some young interns from National Review. Oh, this will be fun. I'll just fuck all their wives in front of them.
Being fucked by Strom Thurmond. It's like filling up a condom with air duster. I want to say, like, I really like two things from this reading. One is Scalia was built like a tank. Built like a tank when they're referring to, like, a middle linebacker or a heavyweight wrestler or something like that. Not a guy who looks like he was born sitting down.
He was built
athletic about his ability. He's just a fucking fat Italian man.
He was built like one of those guys from a cartoon who's poor and is wearing a barrel. That's how he was built.
Again, like any normal person would look at him and like you said, just see a very fat old Italian man. But this is exactly like how
Douthat would look
at a fucking corpse like William F. Buckley and think, oh, what a spry old man. He's Oh, God, like, yeah, he's still, his wit sparkles and it's just as sharp as the gleam in his eye. It's like,
Scilly is just like gorging, just sweaty and disgusting, and he's got like fucking horseradish in the folds of his neck, and they're just like, my God, what a man.
If Dom DeLuise was racist, these people would write things that are like, he had a magnificent magnetic quality to him. His shortness just belied how powerful he was. His ideas built towers above him. I like that Scalia, like, with a stare, commanded them to get dinner. It's like, that's sort of like the sociopathy that I like about conservatives. It's not enough that he can just be a fat fuck and get drunk and eat 3,000 calories worth of food. He has to drag everyone down with him.
Yeah.
Enjoy it. He's like, yeah, you'll eat too. He gets enjoyment out of watching this nerd sweat.
I guess because it says appetites, man of many appetites. In that story, it's really just one appetite, but I guess it's two. It's the appetite for food and then the appetite for suborning lesser men to your will.
And those are the only two things you can have an appetite for. This is, by the way, how people used to write about fat guys in the 1800s. Like, this is whenever, like, a business magnate who smoked 32 cigars a day and would you wake up and shovel a plate of oysters in his mouth and eat three dinners because his doctor told him and kept his brain vapors at bay? Fucking when it would go to whorehouses and be like, give me a raw chicken post-haste, bad boy. And then they were just disgusting people, but because when they wrote about them, they'd be like, oh, we called him Baron. Count Eustace Carmichael, the railroad baron. He had great appetites when really he was just a gross fat fuck.
Victorino Mattis, young Victorino Mattis, again was forced. He probably went home and threw up.
Barfed. Yeah, booted the whole thing, but he kept it in a bag.
Yeah, but he was, as a memory of his.
Yeah. This is the time that Anna Scalia made me do something I didn't want to do.
And this is so funny. I mean, this was the Weekly Standard's like one of their official remembrances of him right after he keeled over from a lifetime of gluttony. But and the other thought I had about this, I mean, we started this subject of all it took was one death to like basically pull, you know, save the right of collective bargaining for millions of public sector workers. I mean, if that fucker had maybe had another 60 oysters on that night, we could have probably saved the Voting Rights Act, too.
Oh, yeah.
There's going to be competing teams of time travelers who are going to go back. Like, the Koch brothers are developing a time machine to send people back and, like, beg him.
Working on a time machine right
just
now.
Just beg him, go back in time and beg him to do some sit-ups. and then there's going to be another group of liberals going back to just put a trail of like Hostess products to his house every day.
Little boy Antonin, and they're gonna buy the house across the street from him, and like the setup will be a kindly old couple that just gives him caramels and lollipops.
This is that'll be Rand Paul's redemptive mission with the Kochs after his failure campaign. They'll be like, Rand, we need you to go back and get Scalia in law school and teach him CrossFit. Yeah, if you fail this mission, we will leave you in 1958.
Rand would probably be fine with that. So.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd volunteer for this mission for sure.
My life for you. Either
you lose or I win.
Time Rand.
Worst Time Cop sequel.
Time Rand. God. Again,
it goes back to like the Civil War. Tries to convince Lincoln not to.
He's like, hey, Lincoln, it's the Constitution.
You can't issue a currency that's not backed by a precious metal.
Think of the Constitution.
He goes back to the Lincoln Douglas debates, and he's like, "Nice ad hominem. Where'd you get more of those?"
We're adding Time Rand into the Trapa screenplay ideas.
And then for fun, he just goes to the Supreme Court for when they issued the Lochner ruling and just jerks off for fun. Just like while they're saying it, just, yeah, that's right. Oh, God. Right to contract. Yes.
Okay. Moving down the hot take roster. Next on the list, Trump, Donald Trump, the Punisher. He's cleaning up Hell's Kitchen of abortionists one by one, taking them out, and the women who employ them.
I feel – I honestly – this is one of the few times – because obviously everybody on the left, whenever he was bagging on Republicans during the debates, always felt kind of a twinge of enjoyment because he would say things about how much of a corporate whore and low-energy piece of shit Jeb Bush was, and you'd just be like, hey, he's not wrong. But like since it's whittled down and since his rallies have turned into these Nuremberg hellscapes, there's been a lot – obviously it's a lot harder to sympathize with him. But I got to say I genuinely feel bad for him for this because obviously Trump doesn't give a shit about abortion. He's on record. He's on record as having been pro-choice as late as the 90s.
By the Maureen Dowd in her column today this week asked him if he'd ever gone out with a woman who had an abortion. And he said, nice question. Let's move on.
Yeah, what's the next one?
What's the next one?
So obviously, doesn't give a shit about abortion. No question. But he knows he has to be against it because he's a Republican nominee. Because of all the other issues and all the insane shit he said, he hasn't had to deal with the subject at all. He gets this question because he is flying by the seat of his pants and doesn't really have any kind of prep team. When they say it to him, he's just like, okay, I got to be against abortion. What does that mean? And then he thinks of it just the way anyone would as a logical proposition. If abortion is murder, then a woman seeking an abortion is basically analogous to someone who would hire a hitman. Therefore, they're criminally liable and should be punished. And he has no idea that even though that it might be the logical outgrowth of pro-life positions, that the actual pro-lifers have tried very hard to stifle that idea because of how violently unpopular it is. And so he just blithely stumbles into this thing in an effort to appeal to these people. Well, that's what you people like, right? You don't like abortion, right? Whatever we got to do to get rid of abortion, that's what we do. And it's like, no, oh, shit.
What's so
he
good
totally
about
screwed their con.
No, he screwed their con yet again, perhaps in the most spectacular way yet. Because what I love about that Chris Matthews clip of him being asked that is what's so funny about it is exactly like you said, Matt. You can see the wheels turning in his head when Chris Matthews says, should abortion be illegal? And he's like, yeah, of course it should be illegal. And they're like, well, you know, what should be the punishment then? And then, like, he's just sort of like, you can see him, like, his head rocking back and forth. Well, you know, maybe. Well, there should be some punishment. There should be some punishment. There has to be, right? You know, as you would. If something is illegal, usually you're punished for it if you break the law, right? And it should also be noted that I think in pretty much every other country where abortion is illegal,
the women are absolutely liable.
Like, for instance, Northern Ireland, El Salvador,
Nicaragua,
The women are absolutely put in jail for getting an abortion, lengthy sentences.
Sense. It's the only proposition that makes sense. And it's like they don't want to confront the reality that for most people who say they're pro-life, their commitment to that is very vague and kind of theoretical. And like, yeah, it's a baby. It shouldn't die. But if you confront them with the actual realities of what it would mean to make it illegal, just are repelled by it. They've been trying to, like, balance between those two for a generation.
Now, when this happened, I saw Sean Davis of The Federalist. We all know Sean Davis. He's sort of the baby teeth looking serial killer guy from
another great example of someone you should be looking at while you're listening to this, because holy shit,
he has one of
the more uncanny looking motherfuckers on the right, and that's saying a great deal.
He just has like a shark. He just has row after row of like little teeth behind.
Yeah, those teeth goes all the way down his throat.
I disagree. I think his teeth look like little yellow popcorn kernels. And he has a very thin row, a single row of them, and he takes all his food through a straw. Like, he looks like he would break his jaw if he tried chewing on something. he is the Carlos the Accursed of the Federalist.
I mean,
they all have some variety of, like, Habsburg recessive nightmare gene.
Molly Hemingway, of course, is Elizabeth the Great. She's a dime.
He's a horrific looking individual.
And, of course, Kevin D. Williamson is Vlad Tepes.
Yes.
And speaking of Kevin D. Williamson, he is a man who has in the past taken this position to its logical conclusion and said that women who have abortions should be hanged, but is also staunchly anti-Trump, and he has not yet spoken on how he feels about this.
Sean Davis has, like I said, Google image search him. He's a horrific looking individual with equally horrific opinions on everything. And he was replying to something I think Jill Filipovic said, who was trying to pin him down on exactly this issue. Like, how can you think abortion is murder and think the woman – and he goes, I absolutely think abortion is murder, and that the doctors that cut up healthy babies and sell their organs should absolutely be put in jail. Don't you? And again, they skip right to the doctor.
Yeah. They're kicking women's doors in and sucking these kids out with a fucking Hoover while they sleep.
Yeah, so they go to the doctor immediately. And I sincerely replied to him, and I wasn't kidding. I wasn't trying to be snarky. I just said, Sean, I'm genuinely curious. Why would the woman who is party to the grisly murder you just described not be free from legal sanction? And to this day, he hasn't responded to me. It's just been crickets. Because for someone – like, there is no response for him. There's no way they can answer that question.
It doesn't make sense.
In some way revealing the fundamental hypocrisy of their position on this issue.
They're more interested in telling people what to do but not lose. It's everything that, like, you know, Keck Trump 1488 says to these people – which, you know, you take out 18 utterances of Pike or Homo. And, like, yeah, their criticisms of within their own party are kind of right. Like, they won't take it far enough. If you're, like, if you really are that person, they won't take it far enough.
They're, for the most part, happy. They're happy to restrict access to poor women, basically.
Yeah.
Like, they're happy to make life miserable for poor women as part of their greater project of making life miserable for poor people in general.
And, you know, this is what Trump ran into, is that he wasn't fully versed.
He's not versed in that shit,
like,
yeah.
He's an out of, like, he's not initiate in the mysteries of, like, the pro-life cause, which is that the line is that doctors who perform abortion deserve legal punishment, and women who get abortions deserve moral punishment, but they should escape jail time, basically. And the way they can square that obvious contradiction is the only way around it is by basically pretending or actually stating outright that basically all women are coerced into having an abortion in some way, that they're not really responsible because they are I've read this exact line. I forget from who this week, but someone basically said, like, it's the culture's fault. We can't blame women individually for seeking an abortion when the culture has essentially put so much pressure on them to force them into making this violent choice.
Well,
which
I mean, what's
an interesting position.
Yeah, I mean, but I think they're right, though. What's a teenage girl to do, really, when she sees Miley Cyrus periscoping her 15th abortion of the month? I mean, it's gonna infect them somehow.
I mean, I just think it's
the hot new hip-hop song, Watch Me Whip, Watch Me Nay-Nay, Watch Me Dilate, Watch Me Extract.
Oh, God.
I really don't agree with Ray Sremrod changing their group's name to the Vacuum Boys. Really sets bad things, and you wonder why this is such a problem in America.
Well, I mean, whatever. The last thing I'll say on this is that, there's no way you can take this position and not reveal your fundamental contempt for women and just your belief that they, like, are not capable of making moral decisions on their own, basically.
Which That's is right, people. The Trap House is sexist but woke.
Yeah.
That is true. Moving on in international news, the United States got a visit by the official world leader of the Trap House, Turkey's Erdogan.
Blessings be upon him.
Yeah, you know, on episode one, we said that, you know, we officially pledge our support to Erdogan and his AKP party. So we were very excited this week when he showed up in Washington, D.C. to give a speech at the Brookings Institute. But things did not go according to plan because some of his goons were roughing up journalists outside the Brookings Institute. What do you guys make of that?
First, you know, I read a quick headline first that was Erdogan guards assault people at a Brookings Institute. And I thought, what a cynical ploy to make him make me support the war in southeastern Turkey against the Kurds by assaulting the Brookings Institute. I mean, I guess I'll sign on to it now because he did it. But upon further inspection, he was his guards were assaulting
actual Turkish journalists.
Yeah, Turkish journalists and pro-Kurdish protesters. Unfortunately, none of the Charles Lister types got in the way.
Yeah, there are so many fucking lanyards that could have gotten rung around some motherfuckers' necks, and they didn't bother to do it. Shame.
I mean, like, I would feed Speech Boy to the Grey Wolves right now.
I would kick Speech Boy in the stomach right into the pit of the Turkish deep state happily.
Just take Michael Weiss and make Midnight Express 2.
Oh my God! Imagine them tying down Charles Lister and forcibly shaving his neck beard. Oh, I can't imagine anything better, really.
That's the greatest thing possible.
The Turk lusts for Brookings, basically. The Turk lusts for the Brookings Institute, and quite honestly, I think Erdogan is going to finish the job that Nixon and his plumbers were too pussy to do in the first place, which is firebomb the fucking place.
God damn right. As part of his greater project of bringing back the Ottoman Empire, which I fully support.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, look, you can agree or disagree with Erdogan on specific policies all you want, but I don't know anyone who's a serious thinker who doesn't think that we don't need the Ottoman Empire again. It needs Absolutely. To come back. It needs to come back.
What we need for the sake of symmetry is in 2017 we need Putin to declare himself the czar of the reinstituted Russian Empire. Then in 2023 we need Erdogan to declare himself the sultan of the revived Ottoman Empire, and then we got to have the Crimean War again. We got to get the farce part from the tragedy and farce dynamic.
Tayyip, if you are listening, I am happy to be a janissary in the new Ottoman army. I am of partial Baltic extraction. I am 6 feet and 1 inches tall. I am 210 pounds. I can wield a lance.
I volunteer to be a eunuch in the court. Ironically, though. Ironic eunuch.
Now, the other funny thing about Erdogan's visit to Washington is that everywhere he went, he hired out this like fleet of sort of U-Haul trucks with like big kind of digital displays on the side of them that followed him everywhere he went around Washington D.C. And I don't know if you guys saw the photos of this, but there were like these sort of black U-Haul trucks, and the displays kept saying things like, peace plus justice equals Erdogan's vision for the world. like Erdogan is great. And then the other said, expose Gulen. Gulen is supported with American tax dollars. Expose the traitor Gulen. They're just driving around downtown Washington, D.C., sort of like in Blade Runner, the sort of a new life awaits you on the off-world colonies, except it was talking about this obscure Turkish political figure, or maybe not obscure in Turkey. Felix, can you explain who Gulen is and why he lives in Pennsylvania and why he's supported with U.S. tax dollars?
Yes. Well, he isn't really supported with U.S. tax dollars.
Well, Erdogan seems to think
Erdogan.
He is.
He has that network of charter schools, so he probably gets like state money through that. Yeah, but it's not direct.
This is not a joke, right?
No, he does
have a network of charter
schools. He does have a large network of charter schools in the U.S., yes. So that's probably what they mean when they say taxpayer money.
He's a Turkish businessman, but he's also kind of like almost like a cult figure who has a very large following. Like, he's very successful in business, right? But he's also sort of Erdogan's chief political rival.
Yeah, they used to be tight, and then, you know, snakes – you gotta cut the grass to see the snakes, as we always say on that show.
Friendship ended with Gulen.
Yeah. Gulen, by the way, Gulen, due to his charter schools, will be campaigning with D-Ray.
He's wearing that Patagonia fleece right now.
Special Patagonia fez. Gulen was a religious leader that was there in like the embryonic days of the AKP. He was a very influential. He was Well, I think he was like one of the first Turkish religious leaders to meet with a pope, right? He met with John Paul II, and he was a very, very big figure, sort of like a Turkish Joel Osteen, which sounds like a curse that a wizard would subject you to.
Wait, sorry, quick digression. Wasn't it a Turkish guy who shot Pope John Paul II?
He was a gray wolf, yeah.
He was a gray wolf, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Savages.
Speech boy, you're on notice.
Yeah, but he went to America because, well, if you're a religious leader as charter schools, like, I can't really think of a fucking better
place. Yeah, if you're a fucking inveterate born con man, you know, what other.
Well, he was also in the 90s, in the last like gasps of the secular sort of deep state that Erdogan's sort of been at war with since he took power. Part of the reason Gulen left is because he was afraid he was going to get arrested, because the late 90s, the secular regime actually was throwing a lot of Islamists in prison, and he was worried about that. So that was one of the reasons he came stateside.
But like, what's the genesis of their falling out?
It was corruption allegations, and I think, Matt, you can correct me on this if I'm wrong. I think Erdogan's people accused Gulen of leaking a lot of the corruption allegations and said it was a plot to make Erdogan's faction look bad.
No, yeah, I don't know exactly what the cause of the split itself is, but I do know that there was a big leak of these tapes that implicated a lot of high-level Erdogan officials in some pretty spectacular corruption. And yes, Erdogan and the whole regime blamed it on the Gulenists. And so they've sort of been cracking down on them ever since. It's been a couple of years now. And they just recently took over one of the biggest papers in Turkey, which had been run by Gulenists, and now it's an AKP mouthpiece. But I don't know why they actually fought. I don't know. It might have been like a – I don't know if it was like a strategic issue or if it was money or whatever. I don't know exactly why they fell apart from each other at first, though.
Gulen was like, why are you liking my girl's Instagram pic? I just want to say, going back to the Erdogan promotion truck, I really like that Erdogan and AKP have a street team now. And
they're probably putting stickers up on like street like mailboxes and lampposts and shit.
They're handing out their mixtapes.
Exactly. If you're in DuPont Circle, like, some guy is going to go up to you and be like, yo, my man, do you like Justice and Development?
Oh, man.
But as I said in the first show, I'm a big part of the Social Justice and Development Party that we're developing here stateside as an adjunct. Me and Arthur Chu, and it's gone very well.
We're putting it
Erdogan's
together.
Visit helped a lot. Yeah,
we're gonna get.
I've been driving around town in a van, with Erdogan's face on one side and Chu's face on the other. I mean, a few people have called the cops, but you know,
you got the van from the Oscar Mayer company on one of their old Wiener mobiles.
Yeah.
Somebody called
because a lot of people called because they thought that the person on the side of the truck was sick because of how moist he looked.
And Erdogan has referred to Chu's moistness in speeches. He says, we will bleed the swine in Damascus out, and we will make the streets run red with blood as wet as the face of Arthur Chu. And I was like, God damn, that's good rhetoric. Does Arthur Chu know that he's involved in your political party, Matt?
I mean, I've sent some emails. He hasn't responded yet, but he's busy. You know, I mean, there are superhero movies to critique due to their lack of diversity. I understand. He's very busy.
Yeah.
Ninja Turtles have to have their privilege checked. I understand.
Erdogan, by the way, was very good about how none of the women in the Gem movie about Gem the rock star were in fact WOC. That was like a big reason that AKP won re-election, was that he's criticized the movies for their lack of diversity. So I think they're natural allies.
Moving along, another bit of international news. There was a story that week about the guy who hijacked the Egypt Air flight to get back together with his ex-wife. It all ended well.
Genius,
no one died.
Man.
I want to know, did he get back with his ex-wife, though?
I don't think so. I think she was contacted and she's like, no, he's gross and abusive and I don't like him.
Hard to imagine.
I mean, women, right? I mean, what do they want, you know?
But, you know, as far as this guy's struggles go, I was thinking maybe we could maybe call our friend Carl Digler up. And I know he has some thoughts on the terrorism via ex-wife. So can we get Digler on the line? Is Dig there?
Yeah, one second. Hey, Dig, someone wants to talk to you. What these digheads want?
Dig, you're live. You're on the Trap House. We're talking about the guy who hijacked the Egypt Air flight to get back together with his ex-wife. Your thoughts?
I do not necessarily agree with violence in most scenarios, but knowing what I know about Cypriot family court, I have to say that this man is a bit of a hero, and Nelson Mandela was known to use violence in his early days, and I believe that the Fathers Movement sometimes has to resort to extreme tactics.
Mandela's wife did leave him, after all, so he knew the pain.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mandela's wife leaving him was sort of the Selma Bus Movement of the Fathers' Rights Movement. And that makes me the Medgar Evers of it.
So are you does this inspire you at all? Does this give you any hints on new tactics you could use in your battle for your round son Colby?
Readers of my column will know that my Hellenic inner ear syndrome precludes me from most intercontinental flights. I'm usually a bus traveler. And I eschew violence. And my father is a member of the military, so I will not be hijacking any planes. But I have been representing myself in court with documents that I've procured from R Legal, but this has given me a little wind beneath my wings. I will definitely be taking on the Judge Ellen Tao, a little more aggressively.
Well, you know, I got to say, fake suicide vest is a good way to get heard.
That's a great idea, Matthew.
And if it's fake, you can't really be done for terrorism.
William is correct. Due to a clause in the Patriot Act known as the Coward Clause, I would actually be due for compensation if attacked by federal agents while operating a fake suicide bomb.
I thought that was called the Tommy Boy Clause.
Legal yeomen refer to it as the Tommy Boy Maneuver. But esteemed experts such as myself, who have been thrown out of multiple Senate judiciary hearings, know that it is called the Coward's Clause.
Coward's Clause. Dig, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I know you're a busy man. You've got to get back to covering those harassment hordes and those Bernie bros. So stick with it. Keep turning out excellent articles at cafe.com.
Thank you, boys. Have a great one. These streets are live.
That was Carl Digler, everybody.
Wow.
Yeah.
Visit from one of the legends.
How does he make time, to speak to a humble podcast like ourselves?
Hey, you know, on that hotline Dig.
Okay. Last but not least, this is a story that caught my eye this week that I'd like to throw into what I hope will be an ongoing segment on the show called Dystopia Now. This is in the same vein as the pro-Israel robot harassing students at Brown College that we discussed on episode 2. This was an article that was on Vice this week. The headline is, in pod-based community living, rent is cheap, but sex is banned. And essentially this goes on to be a profile of what's referred to as a co-living space called Podshare that was founded in 2012 by entrepreneur Elvina Beck and her father. And essentially what it is it's like 100 beds in what looks like a warehouse. And you pay, what is it, like $60 a night or $50 a night or the low price of $900 a month. To I'll link to this article in the description so you can visit it, but you can pay $900 a month to live in conditions that can best be described as Stalag 17, but with laptops. This is like the new – it's not Airbnb, It's not like, you know, this is the new bleeding edge of like sort of app-based community living where you can live with like 30 other people in some sort of like dorm in bunk beds and where you can't have sex.
This is basically for the people who heard the classic song in the year 2525 and were really excited about it. They thought, oh, man, that's amazing. You got your legs are hanging limp. You're just in a tube. Information comes at your face and your genitals have withered off. This is a – oh, why can't this be now?
I mean, it's about – we're creating a social network with a physical address. Our open floor model offers the highest rate of collisions for social traveler. I guess by collisions they mean like connections. That's weird. But again, no sex.
But yeah, they don't mean genital collisions, the only kind that are actually any fun.
Yeah, it may actually be like the only good – part that I could possibly think about, one of these sort of hostile arrangements. There are also, yeah, I'm reading here, there are also rules that include, quote, no pod sex, which can be a challenge for their queen size pods, which are great for money saver couples. Oh, man. Like I said,
So couples are supposed to move in here, but they can't have sex in their own home.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, wow.
Sounds like people are fast-tracking marriages.
Right? Yeah,
people, folks, am I right?
People say millennials are avoiding marriage, but they're essentially volunteering for some sort of dreadful living arrangement that sounds not too different from it.
You got to know that, like, they've got those giant versions of hamster water feeders filled with Soylent. And you just scurry over to one and suck on it for a little bit in between coding sessions.
So, yeah, like, it looks like a POW camp from, like, World War II, but everyone is on a laptop, basically. There's just one last quote from this I have to read. Quote, sharing an open space with strangers who have their names written beside their sleeping quarters and who cook different foods, leave different toiletry products in the shower, and play different music on the PA system is the reason we travel, Beck said. This is the reason you travel. Think about, that. That sounds like hell to me.
That sounds
like absolute hell.
Oh, my God. I am so glad I get to experience new things and see, like, the type of Dove for Men body wash that other people use and listen to the Nishids that they play versus the Nishids that I play.
So this is like, so apparently this is for people who travel overseas and they when they go to the hostel, instead of just using it as a place to store their stuff while they go out and check out the city that they're in, they hang around so they can watch like a German so they can watch a German backpacker like rinse their underwear in the sink and they're like, this is it, this is the world,
I'm making so many collisions.
It sounds like this entire enterprise is propped up by people with really specific fetishes. Like, they really like to see people empty out their deodorant, wash everything in the sink, like Matt said. I love watching other itinerants fall asleep. I think
Kasich could do well, yeah.
John Kasich could use this as a campaign headquarters. And think about how much shit he could take from these, like, stupid techies. They've never been running to Cuyahoga John like that.
There's no sex, but you can listen to people in the bunk bed next to you furtively masturbate.
I think about this, and then I think about that Kevin Williamson article we talked about 2 weeks ago, and I just imagine a future of continued divergence between the creative / tech class that these people represent, and then the bunch of jobless, sort of undereducated
the
masses.
We'll call them Morlocks.
Exactly. It would be a Morlock and Eloy situation. Only instead of the Eloys hanging out in a garden playing lutes or whatever, they're sexless gerbils packed up into these towers like the Matrix, only voluntary. And then outside of the building, it's just a wasteland of like pickup trucks on bricks and the fucking like Van Halen's playing at air splitting decibels and people are like playing paintball without shirts on. I gotta say, I would rather be outside.
Yeah.
Even if we're dependent on, you know, a crane full of UN wheat being dropped on us to prevent us from starving, I think I'd take that over the intravenous Soylent enemas that we would get being in the habit trail.
Being in the pod space living arrangement. I every week I find myself asking myself, you know, which fictional dystopia is the year 2016? And, you know, the pro-Israel robot, we established that that was Philip K. Dick, or Philip K. Dickstein, rather. Usually I feel like we're living in a Paul Verhoeven movie, specifically RoboCop, Total Recall, or Starship Troopers. But this one, I got to say, the pod-based community living does strike me as more of a J.G. Ballard kind of vibe.
Yes. High-rise with coding, nobody horny at all.
Also, like his memoir, Empire of the Sun, where he actually did grow up in a POW camp, and it's a great book. I highly recommend it. But it sounds a lot like this, in that there was like virtually no privacy, and you're like picking weevils out of like your gruel with like the nice British couple who don't talk to you because they're the impropriety of it would be too much. So yeah, 2016, everybody. The future is now. It's all happening.
I would like to announce that I have my own enterprise going, with my own living pods, but the only thing is that sex is mandatory.
Sex with you?
So, yeah, I mean, not, you know, I am technically like Gulan, a spiritual leader of this community, and it's encouraged, but, like, if you just, you know, if you're lonely and you don't mind sleeping in open air proximity to other people, come to Felix's fuck pods. We have a location in Astoria. We're looking to expand to New Rochelle. And in 2017, we are going to be in the Midwest.
It's going to do very well amongst Bernie bros who are owed sex.
That's right. And cannot afford regular living situations. And they've been
right, because
their places because they're prodromal gamers and have attempted to kill their parents.
Well, this actually, I think this makes a good segue into our next topic of the week. You know, this has been going on. We were going to address it last week, but like there was just not enough time. So, and I figured we were just going to drop it because I find him to be basically a cynical person, and I think he's just trolling. But we kind of have to address it. It needs to be addressed, and I'm speaking, of course, about Jonathan Chait. And his series of articles are sort of little like blasts over the past 2 weeks, attacking, as he sees it, sort of Marxism as represented by Bernie Sanders and Jacobin magazine. Did you guys?
And also it? Stalin. Don't forget Stalin.
Yeah.
Stalin lurking in the background. He's the Emperor Palpatine of all of this.
I really don't agree with Bernie making Stalin his running mate. First of all, he's been dead for over 60 years. But
not in my heart.
Yeah.
He lives in my heart forever.
So basically, at New York Magazine, Jonathan Chait, 2 weeks ago, he had a piece that was a blog post or whatever you want to call it titled, A Reminder That Liberalism Is Working and Marxism Has Always Failed. And this was in response to that Vox profile of Jacobin magazine. And, you know, I mean, there's definitely a tinge of jealousy in all of this, but it's a very lazy piece. I mean, I don't know if we could, like, need to go through it point by point, but basically
– It
doesn't deserve it. Chait makes a number of ridiculous, like – confused, like he just has a lot of things are very confused. He doesn't really define any of his terms, but basically it boils down to that contemporary American liberalism is the best of all possible worlds, and that attempts, you know, people who are saying that it's not good enough or we need something better are basically paving the road to the gulag, basically. And I'm just gonna, I guess, read the I don't know what he said. Basically, he says, the case for democratic, pluralistic, incremental, market-friendly governance rooted in empiricism, i.e. liberalism, has never been stronger than now. What an odd time to abandon a successful program for an ideology that has failed everywhere it has been tried. And I guess, like, okay, what I'll say about this is, you know, if you want to address, you know, centrally planned economies and single party states and why they are always totalitarian, that's one thing. Maybe we can have one of our friends from Jacobin magazine come on and defend Soviet totalitarianism. But I wanted to address the second part of this because the first part is too stupid. The idea that contemporary American liberalism, as represented by Obama and I guess I assume Hillary Clinton, is working.
We're all going to be drowning in the fucking rivers of blood-tinged saltwater within the next 50 years. It's going great.
Yeah, and I guess my response to Jonathan Chait is the contemporary American liberal project is working so well that all it would take is the Republicans winning this current presidential election to basically usher in the blood rains, like to just to basically to bring about the apocalypse. That's all it would take is them. The American liberalism is working so well that like a bloodthirsty, revanchist, just totally unhinged conservative movement controls both the House and Senate. And as we said, up until Scalia dying, basically the Supreme Court.
And the vast majority of state houses and governors.
The vast majority of all of the states, which they are proceeding to, like, look at what Sam Brownback is doing in Kansas or what Bobby Jindal did in Louisiana. That is a vision of things to come. Like what is happening in those states is what will happen in this entire country should the Republicans just win one presidential election. And don't fool yourself. It could very easily happen this year.
Since 2008, Democrats have lost 900, more than 900 state legislature seats, 12 governorships, 69 House seats, and 13 Senate seats. The enterprise of – that's how good the enterprise of liberalism
is.
Yeah, but hold on a minute. That's because a bunch of progressive, quote-unquote, college Bernie bros had a sad about Obamacare and didn't vote in the midterms. That's why that happened.
Thank you for quoting my favorite delusional fucking drug addict. I guess fucking benzo withdrawal does make you hallucinate things. What a fucking pig that person is.
That person shall remain nameless.
Have another fucking drink, lady.
Yeah, we'll leave that one aside. But, yeah. I don't know. What do you guys have to say about this? I mean, like, the idea that like I said, I just don't know where this comes from, and I guess the only answer for it is that for a guy like Jonathan Chait, American liberalism is working great.
Well, I mean, a lot of it ends up whenever they're – and they end up mostly defending the Obama administration, and so they end up defending Obamacare, really, because if you are making an argument that American liberalism is not responsive enough to the needs of the majority of people – there isn't a lot in the last 8 years that you can point to. And, of course, you can just bring up the issue of GOP intransigence. But there was that two-year period at the beginning of Obama's term when they had the Senate with a supermajority and the House, and they were able to pass mostly what they wanted to pass. And so they passed precious little, really. And the crown jewel of what they passed is Obamacare. And so these people end up having to just – basically create this delusional version of Obamacare to sort of sell American liberalism as embodied by the Obama era as successful to responding to people's needs. Because and you have one element of it that for the most part nobody can argue isn't good, Medicaid expansion. That's been very good for people. And if it hadn't been for Scalia and the rest of the toads on the Supreme Court, that would be nationwide instead of the situation now where it's most needed. Revanchist shithead neo-Confederate governors have refused to implement it. But Obamacare itself, the meat of it, has been mixed at best and has left millions of people in a situation where they are paying to avoid a IRS tax penalty, are paying for health insurance that they literally can't afford to use because of how high their deductibles are. That's not a situation where you can say, look at the kind of responsiveness and agility and success that this has had, especially since that's literally all it hangs on, because otherwise it's been a complete failure to pass any kind of meaningful domestic reform.
It didn't seem like it would be as fucking awful when there was a public option still on the table, but as everyone knew would happen, Obama immediately gave it up. Part of his just long-running 8-year brilliant chess game of being a complete center-right pussy It's just going to pay off any day now. But a public option would have been the counterance to neo-Confederate governors taking away the Medicaid expansion. But of course, if you look at people like Chade or Dr. Vox or any of these fucking people, ask them about the South. Ask them if they give a shit about people in the South who they just the constant narrative of they're voting against their own interests. You know, go die for all we care. And they wonder, you know, they wonder why they're losing seats over and over and over and over again.
And you but know,
I just,
there
I just
was,
don't there understand was... thinks that this is like at all tenable in the long run. It's just like I know he assumes that the Democrats are in a good position to keep winning the presidency, but what, not indefinitely?
And even if they did, so like, what? That like, that gives you that yeah. gives you gridlock and status quo that has led to climate disaster on the very, very near horizon and absolute stagnation for everybody else, and a crumbling infrastructure and mass incarceration and go down the line. That's your best bet. And
okay, now, you know, Chade, like I said, I don't think we really need to talk any much more about him because I think he's basically lazy and I think he's just trolling. I think he knows what will get him clicks. I mean, like, you know, he confuses it. Like, the one of the things he identifies as part of, quote, socialism is the sort of PC identity politics of, like, the campus left, which is like.
Well, because they get their principles of procedural justice from Marxism, which is tenuous at best and totally ignores the fact that there's a genuine conflict between these two groups of people.
Yeah, exactly.
Between,
if you follow
between
any
actual
of that.
Marxists and these cultural Marxists, which. When he embraces that, he's literally becoming an alt-righter.
Yes. No. His definition of Marxism is the cultural Marxist term that only sort of like you know race science anime jackoffs on the alt-right believe in. You know.
John Chade, 1488.
Tech Chade.
But I think the broader issue here is like what we were talking about, like for people like Jonathan Chade and a sort of like older class of, you know, Democratic or people who consider themselves liberal. What's really being brought out in this election is that they seem to think everything is fine and that the people, mostly the young people that are really going in for Bernie and making this a very tight Democratic, primary are essentially that there's something wrong with them for wanting more than the status quo or the idea to hope for a better future or to care about politics outside this very narrowly prescribed parameters is not only foolish but dangerous in a way. And that seems to me coloring a lot of the sort of like generational split in the Democratic Party right now.
And it's just so disgusting to read him from his position of absolute self-satisfaction at the top of this pinnacle of liberal progress, when his argument, incremental liberalism is as good as we're going to get, if that the people who held that belief at every previous point in American history, if they had gotten their way, then all of these things that he takes credit for in terms of racial and gender equality and in terms of a more democratic polity and more economic justice, none of those things would have happened because they would have been because those people
that,
fought against
that,
every single time that there was some sort every single time you in the history of American progressive movement, it was a force outside of mainstream liberalism pushing left that pushed things in the direction of genuine change. I mean, Jonathan Chade in 19 during the Birmingham protests, he would be one of the moderate clerics who Martin Luther King wrote letters from a Birmingham jail to.
Also Chade's big endorsement of liberalism is its principle of free speech. When he cries about the people who suppress Donald Trump's right to free speech, he's talking about, you know, the protesters in Chicago. When he made his name in 2002 and 2003 in the lead up and beginning of the Iraq War, the entire thing that he built his name and his entire career on was hippie punching, was tone policing people from the left who are protesting a war that this Henley shirt wearing fucking movie reviewer who has never even thrown a punch in his life, was defending with his entire life and honor. He was suppressing the speech of people who were right while he was wrong, using his authority as the fucking New York Magazine theater critic.
Well, no, wasn't he at with the New Republic at that time?
Oh, even better. Even better.
Yeah, he was one of Marty Peretz's, like, you know, proteges or whatever. And yeah, he was a huge hawk for the Iraq War, and he's like, you know, the sort of the contract that he got in that regard was spending many of his columns attacking the anti-war left and sort of setting the limits of what was considered, you know, decent or acceptable opinion, which of course was all the pro-war position. And now he regards this now, if you bring it up, if you, like, you know, just reply to anything he says with good point, Jonathan, but you supported the Iraq War. He gets
a nice ad hominem. Yeah.
He thinks that's
I bid you good day, sir.
He thinks that's an ad hominem attack. And the funny thing is, like, you know, if Hillary becomes president, or even worse, some fucking Republican gets in there and finds a way to, like, I don't know, intervene in the Ukraine or Syria or something, I'm sure Jonathan Chait will find some way of supporting that again.
Oh, I'm sure. That's
what he does.
Contortions. He'll definitely scratch his chin a lot, and he'll be tormented by it for a paragraph or two before he clears his throat and says, "We might have to kill half the people in the Eastern Hemisphere."
Jonathan Chait, he hates the Bernie supporters, and he hates the campus people, and he hates the people who protested Trump in Chicago, who, you know, by the way, Chait is another one of these guys who says that people denied Trump his freedom of speech because what really happened is that they called him on his bluff.
He bitched out.
Everyone saw he was a pussy and ran. And, you know, a guy like Chait, who's been a fucking pussy his entire life, what party is he going to relate to here? But they hate these groups of people because they've been politically effective without the help of your Jonathan Chaits or Michelle Goldbergs. And the thing, this is the same fear that the never Trump conservatives have. They're really not afraid of any political outcome. They believe they will be fine in any set of political outcomes. What they're really afraid of is irrelevance. They're afraid of any political outcome that shows them that no one more than 50,000 people on Twitter and the few people in Washington, D.C. read them, and that they have no influence on the world, and no one gives a fuck about them. And if somebody shot Jonathan Chait in the back of the head tomorrow, it wouldn't even make the front page of New York Magazine where he writes. And that's their fear, that they're just complete fucking factotums, that you could write a Markov chain that could write Jonathan Chait's columns for him, that when he gets in arguments with people and links their tweets, that no one gets on his side, because who gives a fuck about Jonathan Chait? No one fucking likes him, or is their ideas are influenced by him at all. And that's what scares them more than anything else in the world.
You know, you mentioned Michelle Goldberg. And, you know, another thing that annoyed me this week, you know, it was like, okay, she was responding to the thing Susan Sarandon said, which, you know, whatever. I mean, Sarandon basically made some kind of weird accelerationist argument, but, I mean
– Well, yeah, she said that some Bernie supporters might vote for Trump and that Trump might – but she never said she was going to vote for Trump, which is what ended up everyone talking about.
And the Michelle Goldberg and many others were like, well, Susan Sarandon, I mean, obviously she's so privileged. I mean, obviously it doesn't matter to her who's the next president. It's, you know, easy for her to live through a Trump presidency or whatever, which, you know, it'd probably be easier for her than many other people. But, like, you know, the obliviousness of these people, it's like – What about the privilege of people who would be, like, just totally fine with just this awful status quo grinding on for another 10, 15 years? I mean, this is what we're talking about, like, when we introduce this thing. Like,
yeah.
It's not working. It's not
their absolute conviction that this status quo is the Panglossian best of all possible worlds. And so, yeah, any attempt to destabilize it, even if it's a noble effort to move it in a more equitable direction, is inherently dangerous and unresponsible, because it might upset this apple cart of utopia, which is insane gibberish. But I just wanted to say one thing about that Sarandon deal. I mean, she started by saying the thing, but well before she had said that, I saw all over online, over and over again, you'd see the Twitter, the Hillary people would press this issue of, well, will you vote for Hillary in the fall? Will you vote for Hillary in November? Which in a contested primary is absolutely a moot point. Who gives a shit?
You said,
that has nothing
Bernie
to do.
Sanders is not Ralph Nader.
He's not Ralph Nader. That's the thing. They all treat Bernie like Ralph Nader. Like, are you going to vote for Bernie in the fall? It's like, bitch, we have primaries happening right now. They're after Nevada just flipped hilariously. They're freaking. They are 15-15 in terms of caucuses
exactly.
And primary not context. Only... It is a slugfest. There is no issue where you're moving beyond. But they are so used to arguing on behalf of establishment Democrats on the basis of a lesser of two evils argument that's all they have. They have no – and now they're in a situation where it's within the party. It's not a third-party issue. It's somebody fighting for the Democratic position who's clearly to the left of the establishment candidate. And these people claim to have left values, so they can't really attack him on the issues without looking reactionary, and they have nothing else to do. So their brains essentially short circuit,
and they
return to the command line of the program, which is electability, lesser of two equals privileged. Republicans are worse. It's like, bitch. Fucking Bernie Sanders, by every metric, looks like a stronger general election candidate than Hillary Clinton. Maybe that's not true. It's very hard to take
matchup
polls at this point and extrapolate them outwards. But the Republican Party is literally eating itself right now. For me, it's very hard to see them winning in any situation. This is the best chance we have basically had in my lifetime to nominate and elect someone who is genuinely to the left of the neoliberal consensus. And
absolutely.
They can't handle that because they can argue against it in good faith. They have to just freak out and talk about this phantom electability.
No, they can't argue about it in good faith. And what annoys me so much about it is that they hide behind this electability argument. I've heard the idea, oh, well, you didn't live through McGovern or whatever. And it's just like,
oh my God.
Well, McGovern. I mean, this is not the same
country. When the electorate was, what, 90% white?
Yeah, this is not the same country that it was
when every other American was Archie Bunker, essentially.
And the reason it bothers me is because like they're not arguing in good faith, because if they did, they would just simply say that they oppose Bernie Sanders politically. They do not agree with his politics, whether it's they don't want to pay more in taxes or they're not sufficiently convinced by he'll be hawkish enough in the Middle East. I don't know.
They have pretty good insurance with whatever legacy media outfit they're with, that they don't care about the idea of single payer.
No. Yeah. And again, like this electability argument is a coward's argument. Like, not only is Bernie Sanders not Ralph Nader, he's not Dennis Kucinich either.
Mm-hmm.
This guy has now won exactly – they're tied in terms of with Hillary. And so he's winning major states. And every national poll I've seen shows that he would beat any of the Republican candidates.
Yep.
And again, it's hard to say how that would play out in a general election, but fucking Hillary Clinton.
There's no data set on the other side to be a convincing argument that she is a manifestly better general election candidate at this point.
Hillary Clinton, who her entire justification for the Iraq war vote has now turned into like, oh, I was afraid that they were going to be mean to me. who has just fucking crumbled and panicked in every flashpoint of every choke point in a tough race in her life. Remember when she lost Iowa and she immediately dispatched Bill to South Carolina to say racist things? Nothing she does makes sense. She's a fucking panicky Pete, and this is our paragon of electability.
Yeah, a paragon of electability who's currently under investigation by the FBI and who has a trail of fucking slime running from her, you know, decades long. I mean,
hey, look, a lot of people look. Once you get older and you realize how things work, you'll realize it's totally normal to get a $5.8 million donation from the King Salman Institute for the Sword Charter. I can't wait to see if she, you know, doesn't blow it one last time, which, you know, is always possible, and gets the nomination, runs against Trump. I cannot wait to see them resurrect Mark Penn, and their strategy will be like, all right, Hillary, you're going to be more racist than Trump.
We're going to spend $5 billion on targeted Facebook ads for Zoroastrian train enthusiasts.
Oh, David the Milk Milkberg.
I mean, I guess what I find depressing about this, this generational split, is the people of the sort of boomer generation who, you know, again, fancy themselves as being liberal, as being, you know, the generation that ended Vietnam and civil rights, et cetera, which are debatable to begin with. But they were the generation that raised – our generation to believe in, like, you know, hope, and that you know you can be anything, and the world, you know, like, you can work for a better tomorrow. And now when they're up against, like, their kids with a viable political alternative, are basically, their attitude is, it's foolish at best and dangerous at worst to even try to hope for a future.
It's a two-pronged thing. Part of it is that they see Bernie Sanders and they see the person who did not sell out, which kind of fills them with sort of a self-loathing. But also, it shows that they're basically irrelevant. And that's the thing they can't handle. Like Felix was saying about Che, they cannot process the idea that people are coming up with their own – coming up in life with their own political compasses, and that they can navigate the world and, you know – figure for themselves what makes sense, and they don't need their freaking op-eds in Mother Jones to tell them otherwise.
Okay, we need to raise the voting age to 21 because you know, teenagers are stupid. We need to raise the voting age to 21 or even 25, but we need to cap voting at age 60. And I'm 100% serious about this.
Yeah, I mean, people were talking, I forget who wrote it, but some dipshit wrote an article or a tweet or something about how Hillary voters have skin in the game as opposed
first
to...
First of all, anyone who uses that phrase...
Yes, it's like boots on the ground or blood and treasure. I'm a fucking dipshit who wants to sound like I know what I'm talking about.
No, whenever they say skin in the game as it results to people, I just think of Dr. Mengele or something.
Yeah. So they were saying, it's like, motherfucker, how do these people with one foot in the grave have skin in the game? They are probably not going to live to see a freaking blood-dimmed tide of seawater come and choke them to death.
Can I read a joke from my coworker, Rob Wiseman?
Yeah, please do.
From Rob Wiseman. You can follow him at Rob Wiseman on Twitter. Imagine if your roommate made you watch a movie and left 10 minutes into it. Dick move, right? My point is, old people shouldn't get to vote.
Hear, hear.
Absolutely.
He's a wise man. That's why they call him that.
It's a good joke.
No, exactly. Like, they started the movie, they're checked out, and we got to sit to the end of all 3 hours of Batman versus Superman, basically.
Yeah, when fucking Doomsday shows up, it's going to be pretty gross, I got to tell you. I just want to say one last thing about Marxism and Chait. Marx is, I think, a thinker who has almost a limitless number of insights to put in any – he's a heuristic, I think, more than anything. He's not – I'm sorry, anime not Marxists and tankies, but I don't think he's a dogma. He is a heuristic. He is a lens to look through things and kind of clarify things. And one concept from Marxist thought is the concept of bourgeois sentimentality. And I don't think you can get a better example of that than Jonathan Chait weeping tears over the black eye that, like, Zephram Dinglebert got at the Trump rally in Chicago versus the 500,000 people who died in Iraq that he is barely fucking dealt with.
Well, I want to close out on Chait because I do remember in the column or one of the many columns he did that was sort of his mea culpa for supporting the Iraq war – like, for saying, I was wrong, but for the right reasons, you know? Yeah. He said, you know, many people on the left, referring to the illiberal left, you know, these people who don't believe in freedom of speech.
As they're now being called by Sam Harris fans, the regressive left.
Yes, the regressive left. As many people of them, like, you know, as regards me, I'm not quoting him. I'm sort of reciting from memory because I couldn't be bothered to find this piece of shit column. But he said, you know, many of them think people like me, who initially supported the Iraq war, should simply go away and not write or talk or speak anymore. And I just want to say, Jonathan, you're right. Go away.
Fuck off.
Stop writing. Fucking retire. Like, just spend time with your kids. Just do whatever. But
you know what? Fuck that.
Stop writing.
Don't even leave your kids. I'll raise them better.
Jonathan, what's your wife's email?
Fuck you.
Jonathan, where's your wife at? What are her feet like?
I want to email your wife some Grubhub coupons.
Okay. All right. Well, guys, we're coming up at about the end here. We were going to read we're going to do another reading, but I think we should save that for another show. So I'll give a little because it deserves a lengthy there's a deep dive, but I'm just going to give
we're you – We're giving you a taste right now, people.
I'm going to give you a little preview in the Chapo Trap House reading series. The theme is we sort of delving into the sexual pathologies of members of the right-wing media. And coming soon, perhaps next week, we will investigate a series of columns. It was actually a two-parter by the author and radio host Dennis Prager called – When a Woman Isn't in the Mood. And this is Dennis's really his strategy, his Dennis-dom for why married women should give up the pussy even if they're not in the mood, basically on demand. Okay, so that's coming up soon. Again, I probably should have given a trigger warning for that, but suffice to say, it will curdle your fucking soul to think about this. So keep that in mind. Coming soon, next episode of Chapo Trap House, we will probably talk about Dennis Prager and his many, many marriages.
Oh boy. And I think at the end here, I do think that we should get some sort of credit for being the only people online who were not watching WrestleMania right now.
That's true.
Right. That's right.
Okay. So to close out, as we always do, I think it's time for another episode of Chapo Death Threats. Again, our totally ironic parody segment.
For entertainment purposes only.
Where we in character threaten violence to someone who's annoyed us this week. So this week, we mentioned him already. It's got to be Speech Boy, Speech Toy 71, Michael Cohen. Honestly, probably one of the top three most repellent people on Twitter, and I mean that 100% sincerely.
He's a fucking goblin.
Michael Cohen, just you're a bitch. I mean, I don't know what else to say, but log off. You suck.
Speech Boy, on a website that features ISIS accounts that and Kingdom of Saudi Arabia accounts that tweet multiple misspellings of "this is an internal affair, fuck you, terrorist." You are the worst fucking account I've ever seen. You're a dumb Michael Weiss. Michael Weiss is at least like clever in his shit. You're bland. You're a blander Michael Weiss.
And Michael, we're gonna find you at a Bernie rally. We're gonna find you at one of these events. We're gonna chloroform you, and then just like when you wake up, your goatee will be gone. But we will have Elmer's glued like the clippings to your forehead.
Michael, I will take your identical twin, Frank Mir, the UFC, former UFC champion, and I will make him twist your leg off.
Sorry, one last thing. I did see Speech Boy this week say, if you call me a hack, you're getting blocked right away, which is something someone who's not at all sensitive about being a hack would do.
Yeah, someone who just has a long list of original thoughts and ideas like Speech Boy.
Speech Boy, dude. I'm going to take those glasses off of you, dude. I'm going to make you walk around a fucking orgy blind as a bat until you run into somebody's dick.
It would be really funny if Speech Boy got syphilis and he was like, well, I know the trolls are going to laugh at me for this. I'm syphilis and I will be contracting madness soon.
Speech Toy, fuck off.
Fuck you.
Fuck you, seriously.
Gargle my balls.
Suck our dicks. No hands, please.
You should be exiled to Kunduz.
Okay. Till next week, guys.
Bye-bye.
See ya.